From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the second day of Donald Trump's Senate impeachment hearing wrapped up, prosecutors among the House managers made compelling arguments with plenty of evidence that the former president repeatedly and consistently told his supporters that he could not lose the November 2020 elections, and that if he did, it would be because the race was rigged. Considering that he convinced so many tens of millions of Americans to vote for him after 4 years of corrupt, demagogic, racist, criminally negligent, and inept leadership is a testament to Trump's communications skills. Today, we turn to one academic who analyzed more than 4 years of Trump's tweets and found striking patterns. Michael Humphrey is assistant professor in the Department of Journalism and Media Communication at Colorado State University. He specializes in digital storytelling. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about his communications in general. I know you looked just at his Twitter feed, but of course, he used, I think, many of those same storytelling techniques in his speeches, some of which were cited in the impeachment hearings, right?
Right. It's very striking. It has been the entire time to see what kinds of techniques he was using different kinds of media. And what stayed the same, but what we saw Wednesday in the presentation of the speeches he was giving and how they lined up with a lot of the tweets that he put out, we saw that he was using the same kinds of narrative techniques that I saw. He uses them more selectively in his speaking, and it depends on who he's speaking to. In fact, when he's speaking to a crowd at a rally, it's a lot more like his Twitter feed. When he talks to the media, it looks like a component of his Twitter feed. And then, you know, there are certain kinds of people in the media who will make him sound a little more like a professional politician. But when you look at the whole corpus of everything he said over the, you know, 5+ years from candidacy to the end of his presidency, there's a lot of consistency in the method, even if there's not a lot of coherence in his message. It kept shifting over and over across time.
So let's take a look at the analysis that you did. You looked at, well, many years of Trump's tweets. I mean, I imagine that was some tens of thousands of tweets. That's a lot of material.
Just a little over 20,000 tweets is what I analyzed. And there were more tweets than that. But the tweets that were filtered out were things like retweets and when he was quoting other people. I wanted to look at just what he was saying. Those retweets are really important for part of that narrative I found, because usually he retweeted things that were complimentary to him or attacking one of his opponents. So that is part of what he always did rhetorically and narratively in his own tweets. But I wanted to look at just his words to understand what he was trying to say narratively.
So you point out in your analysis that he was more effusively positive and more bitingly negative than other prominent figures who you compared him to, which I suppose is consistent with what we've seen of his personality. He has been a leader of extremes, to put it lightly, right?
Right. And that seems really like an outcropping of his personality. He high praise for himself, high praise for those who follow him or he saw as the people he was protecting, the real Americans, high negative lines towards institutions and his opponents, and basically anything that did not fit well with his own sense of his exceptional leadership. And so a lot of times a tweet would have both high negative and high positive emotion words in them. And he used those, I think, very purposely. Like they weren't simply mistakes. There was a reason to use so much emotion language.
And of course, all of this, you know, for 4 years, engaging this way with his supporters via Twitter and, of course, in his in-person speeches, led up to what ended up happening on January 6th. So tell me about the five themes that you identified that appeared on a nearly daily basis in his tweets that, taken together, form this very logical arc that helped construct a whole different reality among his followers.
Right. And it was incredibly consistent, even though it wasn't coherent. And that's one of the important things to point out. A lot of people thought of his Twitter account as being erratic. And if you look at it one way, it was. But if you don't worry about what exactly he's talking about and you think more about how he's talking, then you start to see a theme that emerges that coalesces into five themes. The themes are, one, institutions are impeding me from doing my job, or even before I did my job. And the reasons for that are corruption and negligence. There are all kinds of reasons for that impediment. Another one was, we are being attacked by invaders, and there could be a lot of different kinds of invaders. They could be people coming from the south to the border, all the way to the virus. You know, there were a lot of different kinds of invaders. And those invaders, when we talk about the virus, were usually attached to China, so that the Chinese often became invaders, and sometimes they weren't, that he could switch that very easily. Another one was that he was uniquely qualified to protect us from these invaders. Another one was that real Americans could see the dangers coming, and those who couldn't see it were drinking the Kool-Aid from somewhere else, or corrupt, or evil. And so internal, Americans could be invaders too. We saw this with the Black Lives Matter protests this summer. They often were sort of shaped as invaders in his tweets. And then the final one is, because of all this, the country is an inherent danger. And that's why the emotion words are so important, because there's alarm most of the time to what he's saying. There's also this sense that he is not expressing opinions, but narrating these things, telling you what is happening, not saying, I believe this or I think this, but this is happening. So he sounds more like a narrator of a story than he does a character in the story. Although, and he often refers to himself in third person, he is the main character in the story. He's the protagonist who's protecting all real Americans from the invaders, and being stopped by institutions.
And so when we apply this to what happened on January 6th, give me a sense of what we're talking about here. The enemy, the so-called invaders, were basically Democrats, but eventually his own vice president, Mike Pence.
Right. And so things could very easily shift into any of those five themes. You may be on the right side of it in his perspective. You may be on the wrong side the next day. Mike Pence is a really good example of this. Anything could become the institution if it was trying to stop him. And so that could be anything from a Republican Secretary of State who he endorsed in Twitter when that Republican was running for office, suddenly is one of the institutional forces trying to stop him, or his own vice president, voting machines, a cabal, a whole sort of mastermind that was running this whole thing. Any of those things easily fit into that theme of the institution trying to stop me. And the invasion in that particular case was a steal, something that was invading the real home of America and stealing something precious, which was the election that he rightfully won in this narrative from him. Now, what's interesting about what happened after the election is, and I'm still working on this, to be honest, because this is the latest data. In a lot of ways, I feel like the invaders and the institution sort of start to form together in a way that they hadn't at any other time. And it makes sense why, because it was institutions we rely on for democratic elections that was stopping him. And pulling him out of this seat of power. So they kind of morph together. They're a little bit harder to separate after that. And I think that just makes the message even more potent at that point, because it's all coming together now, which is, you know, not unlike some of the conspiracy theories we were hearing all along these 4 years, that that there was a sort of cabal to try to steal this protector from us.
And so going back to who the invaders were on January 6th, just like Mike Pence went from being friend to enemy, did the Capitol Police also find themselves, many of them, maybe not all, but many of them on the opposite side of where they ordinarily had been held? Those same people flying the Blue Lives Matter flags were now pummeling officers with flagpoles.
Yeah, I think what we saw there is the convertibility of the themes again. So, you know, we saw this actually even before January 6th. We saw times when people who were very angry about the election were confronting police and saying, we've protected you. We have been behind you this entire time. And now suddenly you're the enemy. We know that the officer who died in the attack that day was actually a Trump supporter. At least that's been reported. We know that a lot of people in the Capitol who were protecting the Capitol weren't necessarily opposed to the message, but all of a sudden they became the enemy. And that's how convertible this narrative was. And that's really where the potency is that ability to exchange out parts seamlessly without feeling like it's a contradiction. That is, I think, what has confused a lot of people, but it's actually the explanation of its power.
And then you have, you know, Trump, of course, wanting to stick to the script, and in the days before the Senate impeachment trial, wanting to focus his defense on this myth that he actually did win the election, that the Democrats stole it from him, that Biden is not legitimate. Instead, he ended up losing many of his lawyers, and the ones he ended up with just blurted out. At least on Tuesday, you had Bruce Castor, who's been widely denounced by Republicans and apparently the focus of Trump's rage, who just went out and admitted, well, you know, we don't need to impeach Trump because voters voted him out, essentially, I'm paraphrasing him. And that, of course, is quite jarring to the narrative that Trump had been spinning.
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting because what Twitter did in closing his account, in a lot of ways, I think we've already seen has had some positive effects. Selfishly, I keep wondering what Twitter would look like, what his Twitter would look like right now if he still had it.
Oh, you and me and I think many of us.
I suspect that the narrative would have stayed the same. I suspect the narrative lives in the mind, you know, like the email I've been getting the most is asking the question, you know, was this on purpose, or do you see this as a permutation of his personality? And of course, you can't know that perfectly from text. But it does seem pretty likely that this idea of losing is such an anathema to him that fantasy would be welcomed in taking over. And I think that's what we'd be seeing in the Twitter account right now, is the continuation of this narrative. On the other hand, it's also easy to underestimate his ability to use anything in the media to the advantage of the narrative. And that's exactly what happened the entire 5 years. So everything that's happening, you know, up to the point of the trial would have been used to the advantage. Because any time, for instance, both Tuesday and Wednesday, my local representative, Joe Neguse, has been talking, there's a lot of times when he has said things that would look like the institution trying to impede yet again. And so that it would continue to fit the narrative, and it will continue to fit the narrative for millions of people.
One of the things that you write in your analysis of Trump's tweets is that there is no one single line from a Trump speech or tweet that is going to be the smoking gun urging his followers to violence. This, of course, is a weakness for the prosecution that are trying to make the case. And already you've seen the defense saying in the lead up to the impeachment trial, well, nothing Trump said in his speech on the day of the riot was explicitly directing them to violence, which, of course, is not true because there were plenty of things that were said in the speech as well. But they're trying to sort of separate out the one speech from everything that went before it. Trump spent 4 years laying the groundwork, and in particular those months leading up to the election, for the violence that broke out on January 6th. On the one hand, that's a mountain of evidence. On the other hand, it's hard to pin down, right?
Right. And, but, you know, like, to me, one of the interesting things about looking at it in this more, you know, longitudinal way is looking at the fact that the idea that that some corruption occurred around an election didn't start in November of 2016, didn't start in November of 2020, but in February of 2016, in the first primary in Iowa, I mean, the caucus in Iowa, where Trump accuses Cruz of basically stealing that election.
You're talking about the primary elections before Trump came into office. So,
right. So wow. We're talking about the very first election, technically, he was in, you know, which was the caucuses in Iowa. Didn't win that caucus and started to say that Ted Cruz cheated his way into getting that victory. And that's in Twitter. That's in the history. So this idea goes all the way back to the very beginning of the primary season, in the very first election. And it was there already. In fact, it was there on the day he announced. We know that the concept of invaders was in a very important part of his speech announcing his candidacy, when he talks about Mexicans and that they're rapists and they're murderers, and the invaders are there immediately. The institution shows up very quickly. One example of this is it doesn't always have to be government. Macy's came out supporting and criticizing Trump, supporting immigrants, and so one of the first examples of him flogging an institution is Macy's, not necessarily the Supreme Court or some voting right, but a company, and that's how interchangeable it all could be. And it was there from the very beginning, which tells me it was there before he even announced. This was a method and a mindset that goes all the way back, and you didn't have to change that after the election.
And of course, Ted Cruz is among those who went from being a target to being a sycophant. And many of those people who at one point or another are followers, you know, switch sides. I don't know if there's anyone who's sort of done it multiple times, but you see people who were loyal to him become critics and vice versa.
Yep. And, you know, you win the esteem and you lose the esteem of millions of people with wherever you're being placed inside those set of themes.
What advice would you give impeachment managers who are in these proceedings right now? One of the things that the group Free Speech for People did was send a letter to impeachment managers saying that we need witnesses in this impeachment, the victims of and survivors of the January 6th riot. We need to hear from Trump himself. You should subpoena him. From the senators who are, you know, essentially the jurors, who recounted in the days after the January 6th riot that they tried to reach Trump by phone and couldn't because he was too busy watching everything play out on TV. They were, you know, desperately begging or hoping that he would help them, but he was basically watching them under siege. And so would witnesses help? And what other advice would you give them?
You know, I'm biased towards narratives. I think narratives have an incredible power to them. I think that that telling a story of what happened that day is the most important thing. Yes, live witnesses would make that even more powerful. Yes, emotion behind this makes this more powerful. We've been seeing that in the prosecution's case from the House and the House managers, making an emotional and narrative-based argument about what happened both that day and days leading up to it. You know, I think as long as there's an understanding of a beginning, middle, and end here, then you are at the very least fighting fire with fire. Because, you know, it was a narrative that began the movement, and it didn't start with Trump. Of course, what Trump has been doing this entire time is repurposing messages that were already out in the world. People keep saying, why did they fall for it? A lot of people already believed it. He reinforced the message and fed it back to the public in ways that many people already believe that this is the way the world works. A lot of us watched that day. A lot of us saw what happened on January 6th. We got a better sense than days after that of how horrifying it was. And then, of course, time passes. So to me, I think the House managers are doing what I would have suggested they do, is like, make us relive the emotion, the terror, the fear, and the anger of those days so that we can understand what we understood right away and then gets mitigated with a whole bunch of rhetoric. But ultimately bring us back to that moment and remind us what we were feeling, which was, this is wrong. This is unconscionable. And you know, remembering the hours that passed where the president didn't say anything, and then to hear the president say, we love you. You know, all those things caused rage in decent human beings that day. And we need to be reminded of that. I actually think they're doing a lot of that.
And in fact, as the impeachment trial is proceeding, we're seeing reports that tens of thousands of Republicans are leaving their party. Yeah. And it might be that that's, you know, Trump being kicked off of Twitter and these impeachment proceedings, the fact that he was, you know, became the first president in the history of the U.S. to be impeached twice and is now facing a trial, all of that might be playing into it. What about those who are hoping to carry on Trump's legacy? Let's talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene, who the week before the impeachment hearing at the trial was kicked off of committees by Democrats. It was unprecedented in the modern era, I understand, for a member of Congress to be basically fired from serving on committees. And her punishment was predicated on tweets that she had posted. Is she carrying on? Has she been carrying on Trump's legacy on Twitter?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of commonalities there. I haven't had a chance to look as thoroughly at her Twitter feed as, but I was watching it the week that she was going to be stripped of her committee memberships, and she was doing a very similar thing that Trump would do, which is take news as it was happening in real time and bringing it into the Twitter feed and then repurposing it for a message that sounded very different than the way she sounded in the House chamber during the proceedings to strip her of those committees. So yes, there are similarities, and yes, I believe she's picking up the mantle, as are other people. But I don't think, you know, honestly, I don't think that she is the most dangerous purveyor of this kind of narrative. I'm more worried, and this actually could come from anywhere, but I'm more worried about somebody who refines this technique, you know, and I don't think she's doing that. I think it looks very rough compared to Trump. Even it's not quite as slick as Trump, but somebody could be more slick than Trump in using a similar kind of message that would, one, normalize the technique, but two, look like it's respectable. And
so somebody like Josh Hawley, perhaps.
Yeah, that I'm more concerned about somebody like Hawley. I wouldn't say Cruz uses the technique that Trump uses quite in the same way, but I think the way he uses communication always is towing the line between what we'd consider, you know, traditional ways of being a politician in America and still trying to hold together a base of people who are aggrieved for so many different reasons, you know. And holding that together is holding the anger together. People who can do that and still look like they are above the fray are dangerous.
I want to thank you so much, Michael, for joining us today. Where can people read about your work?
So the article that came out this week is in The Conversation. So you can look there. And I am now working on the academic side of this. Now that I have all the data, I'll be writing up journal articles, which, you know, Sonali means a long time from sure. now. but The Conversation has wrapped up kind of what I found in a nice, quick, easy to read article.
And we'll post a link directly to that as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Michael Humphrey, Assistant Professor in the Department of Journalism and Media Communication at Colorado State University. We've been discussing the Senate impeachment trial of Trump and the former president's ability to convince so many of his followers that lies are truth. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.